This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Recently, The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold sat down for a conversation with Franklin Graham, who, like his father Billy Graham before him, is one of the most influential evangelical leaders both within the Christian world and in American politics. Billy Graham was hardly a left-wing figure, but he spoke at times against racial segregation, he preached alongside Martin Luther King, and he offered religious counsel to presidents from Eisenhower to Johnson to Nixon to Ronald Reagan. Franklin Graham was an early supporter of Donald Trump, and he has remained one as scandal after scandal has hit the campaign and the presidency. Graham has remained stalwart in Trump's corner even while opposing policies like the separation of immigrant families. Eliza Griswold spoke with Franklin Graham as he traveled throughout the Northwest on a preaching tour that he called Decision America.
I've read people talking about your father's message and your message, and your dad saying something along the lines of it, talking about Nixon and talking about moral and ethical mistakes in a general way, but crossing a line. I think he did say toward the end of his life that he felt that maybe he'd crossed a line with his closeness to politics. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you felt about that and what you think he would say about your closeness to politics. Do you feel that you've gotten very close or not
no,
so much?
No, I'm not that close. You meet politicians from time to time. You go to Washington from time to time. For me, I stay out of Washington as much as I can. I don't go up to lobby congressmen or senators. I've been at the White House for a few functions. But I try to keep my distance, but I'm going to speak out on issues that I think are moral issues that we should be speaking out, should be addressing.
Are there any moral issues with President Trump that you disagree on?
I'm looking since he's been president. I don't know if you're talking about going back 30, 40 years of his life.
I'm 50 not years. Sure we're going back 30, 40, and some of them are ongoing.
Well, I don't know. As far as what he's been inside the White House, I don't agree with everything he says. Don't agree with everything he tweets. But he has been very strong on religious freedom issues, which I appreciate.
I was reading that at some point you said you didn't think, you know, people say that he's been mean, and you didn't see anything that he'd said that had been mean. And that surprised me just because, like, the sound bites that I've seen in terms of making fun of people, it's just not morally kind of your jam.
I don't know if it's meanness or if it's just who he is. I mean, he's a New Yorker, and I don't know, you've known enough about New York. I went to school in New York, high school in New York, and New Yorkers have a little bit of an edge, and that's just the way they are. And I don't think he always means it that way. It's just he says things, and they're very sometimes very blunt. But there's a lot of meanness in this world, and you don't have to go too far. Many people in the media business are very mean. there are other politicians who are very mean. You know, he's the president, whether you voted for him or not. He's our president. And if he succeeds, you're going to benefit. Your five-year-old son's going to benefit. My 12 grandchildren are going to benefit. If he doesn't succeed, then we all lose.
So one of the times, it just comes to me now that I actually, when I was watching TV during the inauguration, I saw you stand up and give a prayer. And then I heard the speech that Trump gave, which was pretty apocalyptic, about American carnage. Yeah. And I wondered at that time what you thought of that speech. Did that vision of America ring true to you?
Well, I don't think I looked at it like that. I don't, there's lots of speeches that are there for the moment. I think you have to look at what the man does with his job and the work that he does. The fact that he went to North Korea is huge. The fact that he's willing to talk to our enemies, the Iranians. And I think it doesn't mean that we give in to them. It doesn't mean that we give them what they want, but at least we talk. And I think once a conversation starts, it's easy to work our way through our differences. And I think we need to be talking to Russia. I appreciate the fact that he talked to President Putin. And there's a lot of disagreement. They felt that he should have gotten more aggressive with President Putin. But I don't think that's the way you get things done. I think you talk and you try to work out something that will benefit the people of Europe, people especially the Ukraine. And we need to be praying. As a minister, I want to pray for the President Putin and President Trump, because if the two of them can get along, we can save billions of dollars and not build in arms. And right now, it's almost like the media and those in the Democratic Party want us to have a conflict with Russia.
So in trying to understand Putin a little bit, I've read just a little bit about your on his anti-gay stance, being supportive of that. And also other people, like Mike Pence, for instance, seeing him as a strong leader, that there's something to value in Putin in strong leadership. And I don't know if there's an example for how Putin leads for the West that you think is valuable. Like, is there or not really?
Well, first of all, President Putin is the president of Russia, and he has about, I don't know what his approval rate, but I think it's in the 90s.
It's way high, yeah.
Everyone in the country loves him. He's going to do what's best, what he thinks for Russia and for Russian interest. And we talk a lot about their interference in our elections. I have no clue, okay? I don't know. But I do know that the United States has interfered in many countries' elections. We've interfered in Iran with the Shah. We interfered in Vietnam and put our own people in. We did this in Korea. So I get that. I understand that. We want someone in a country who's going to be friendly to us, that we can work with. And we have tried to manipulate the politics of many nations. And so all of a sudden we get sanctimonious and we get, oh, how terrible, some other countries tried to influence our elections. Well, the Clintons had a huge war chest of money that came from people into their foundation. So, you know, it's easy to point the finger. And I can just tell you that there is enough wrong to go around for both sides.
In the New York Times, there was an op-ed a couple of weeks ago about how the Russians, this Marina Butina and other Russian operatives, had possibly tried to use the evangelical community, like the National Prayer Breakfast, for instance, to try to establish ties over issues like the persecution of Christians, very real issues, where they didn't really, their interest was more in establishing influence than it was in the issue itself. And I wondered if you had any sense of that from Russians, that you thought you'd met people that you thought maybe this interest is not. The question is whether the idea of working together is worth it, or whether you have ever felt that there might be a manipulation going on.
The prayer breakfast.
Yeah.
And I can't speak for them because I'm not a part of the prayer breakfast. But I go to the prayer breakfast from time to time. And I know that the prayer breakfast tries to bring political leaders from all over the world to expose them to what we're doing in our country as far as it relates to prayer. So I appreciate that. The Russians may have used this, of course, this gives us a chance maybe to rub elbows with somebody we wouldn't rub elbows with. I can tell you right now, everybody in that room has the same agenda. They're wanting to be able to rub elbows with somebody that they normally couldn't rub elbows with. So, I mean, everybody in that room.
Human nature. Political nature.
You know, it is what it is.
Okay. With what we're seeing nationally, this pushback against immigrants, against refugees, and when Jeff Sessions invoked Romans to justify the separation of families on the border, I spoke to many evangelical leaders who were pretty disgusted by that.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you felt about that.
I did not support that at all. I thought that was a mistake, and I spoke out against it. It's just got to be a better system. I don't think you take... And first of all, these government-run facilities that take care of these kids have pedophiles working in there. And we should never be taking children away from parents, period. Hold them together as a family. But to take their children away where they can be exposed to pedophiles, and I believe pedophiles need to be dealt with very harshly. I believe not only incarcerating, but they molest a child. I think they would be probably a candidate for the death penalty. You do not, under any circumstances, as an adult, force yourself on a child. I mean, that gets me mad.
Do you think that this family separation is an issue? Immigration in general is something that the evangelical community in its diversity could come together around. I mean, here is an issue that is a moral outrage.
Well, I think they're trying to address it. But I think the president has come around to what we're saying. But he also, the president sees the political football that his opponents, they want to use the children to try to make him look bad. And they want to use that. They're not real eager to try to address this whole border issue. It's a point for them. And this is the sad thing, Eliza, is the politics of all this. And it's to take human lives and children and make a football out of them. Listen, I'm all for children and families coming in legally. I do believe that if you're caught at the border, you ought to be turned around and sent back. Come legally. For people that have been waiting 8, 9, 10, 20 years to try to get their legal status and have someone just walk across the border and get in, no. We need to be a country of law.
So recently, one evangelical leader I was talking to was Ed Stetzer.
Yeah, Ed Stetzer.
So he was saying, do we gain a political advantage through, you know, Supreme Court nominations and protection of religious freedom? And other, you know, the recognition of the persecuted church. Do we gain the political advantage but lose our morality by working with this administration?
No. That's, you know, there's some people sit around and they think too much. President Clinton did a lot of good for this country. But he brought the country also to a low that we have never had before. A lot of the moral issues that Donald Trump has had to deal with go back a number of years. To my knowledge, none of this has happened in the White House. There is a difference. I think we do change. I know I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago. And I hope we all learn from mistakes and we get better for that. So I can't speak. All I know is that as human beings, we're all flawed, including Franklin Graham.
Franklin Graham is the president and CEO of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. And he spoke with Eliza Griswold, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick. Welcome back. Next week on the show, we'll meet a mother who's been deported away from her family to Honduras, and she's been trying to raise her three kids over video call.
Beso, mommy. Beso, mommy.
And then she always wants us to give her kisses through the phone.
Nada. I love you.
I love you too, mom.
Beso, mommy.
That's next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Curtis Sittenfeld is an author you might know from novels like Prep, American Wife, and Eligible, a retelling of Pride and Prejudice. Her most recent is a little less romantic than Pride and Prejudice, though. It's a collection of short stories, mostly set in the Midwest, about people raising kids and facing middle age. And in keeping with that spirit, when we asked her to tell us about one of her very favorite places, she took us to a grocery store in St. Louis.
I'm looking for Gala apples, which are right here. Ugh, that was not a good one. Looks like someone like dug their fingernail into that one and then backed away. So we're in a Schnucks grocery store. Schnucks is a local chain in St. Louis. And this one is in the suburb of Richmond Heights. And it's my go-to Schnucks. We moved to St. Louis in 2007 for my husband's job. We came and we looked at houses. And then at one point, I came into this very store and like saw the produce section, and I thought like everything's gonna be okay. I can live in St. Louis. Like, I think that probably seeing a grocery store and seeing like this is nice, it's easy to find a parking place, made me be able to envision my daily life in St. Louis and what it would be. And in fact, since then, I have spent like 35% of my waking hours in Schnucks. So it was an accurate like glimpse of the future. There's this construction going on. So normally it's very soothing to come into Schnucks. It's a little crazy in the background here. All right, let me get some bananas. I have a friend who teases me that I'm like part monkey or something. Like I eat a banana, an apple, and an orange probably every day. Four of my books have come out in St. Louis. That's crazy. I got married in St. Louis. I had kids in St. Louis. So it's like I do feel like I kind of, you know, officially became an adult in St. Louis. In Schnucks, in this aisle now. I'm gonna get, oh, you know what I need? I need Danimals, actually. A Danimal is basically like a yogurt smoothie. Oh my God, I didn't know they even had cotton candy flavor. I'm looking for strawberry Danimals. Those are rock and raspberry. Yeah, and those are, see, I kind of don't want to buy a 12 pack. I want to buy a 6 pack. Maybe the reason I like the grocery store is I can like privately indulge my finickiness as a human being, and like I don't exactly have a witness. Okay, wait, let me see. One of my kids is very fond of the fried chicken, the prepared fried chicken. We once ate Schnucks fried chicken in the Schnucks parking lot in my car, and I feel like it was like a high moment, a high as mother daughter. I have two kids. One of them has food allergies. If you have a child, or I think any family member who has food allergies, the protocol is every time you buy something, you read all the ingredients on the label every time. So I do think like the grocery store is really, it's tied up in sort of daily life in very mundane, practical ways, but it's also, you know, tied up in like my ideas about like safety and protecting my family. In my fourth novel, which is called Sisterland, it's about a woman who has two young kids, and she lives in St. Louis. She's psychic. So, like, if I'm making fun of the book, I'll say that it's a novel about buckling your children into car seats, but it's about a few other things. But there are literally probably 8 scenes that take place in Schnucks. Literally, the protagonist meets her husband inside this very Schnucks. So I must believe in like the romance of the grocery store at some level. So one time I was at Schnucks paying for my food, and I looked over and I saw this man who I swear to God was exactly as I had envisioned the husband. And in the book, his name is Jeremy. And I thought to myself, like, oh my God, like I conjured him up, or, you know, or he's existed all this time. And I was just channeling his existence. But it was this weird, like he had this kind of little glasses that I pictured, and he was wearing the kind of like parka that I pictured. He was a handsome man, a handsome Schnuck shopper, no shopper.
Curtis Sittenfeld at a Schnucks in St. Louis, Missouri. But she doesn't shop there anymore because she's moved to Minneapolis, where there's no Schnucks at all. Curtis Sittenfeld's most recent book is a collection called You Think It, I'll Say It. And that's it for us today. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Calla Leah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Zach Dyer, Eric Malinsky, Mishi Harmon, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.